to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Heavy metal, as it is known, is one of the most popular and controversial forms of rock and roll music. Nevertheless, it is an important part of American popular culture. It's also the subject of this week's interview. But before we talk about that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. One of the bloodiest crimes in American history drew to a close with a trial jury finding the defendant not guilty of the murders of two people. The crime was committed in an era of swift justice and vast newspaper coverage. It passionately divided public opinion as to the guilt or innocence of the accused, and the trial culminated in the defendant's acquittal. It could very well be the O.J. Simpson trial, but this crime dates to the summer of 1892 when Lizzie Borden's father and stepmother were murdered with an axe, and Lizzie was charged and stood trial for the two murders. On August 4, 1892, a hot summer day in Fall River, Massachusetts, Lizzie Borden was heard crying out to the housemaid that her parents had been murdered. Andrew Borden, her father, was one of the richest men in Fall River. He was found dead with his face cut by 11 blows from an axe. Her stepmother, Abby Borden, was killed in the upstairs guest room, and the autopsy revealed that her body had been struck with 19 blows from the same axe that killed Mr. Borden. Lizzie was charged with two counts of murder. The trial was set for June 5, 1893, but on June 20, 1893, the jury found Lizzie not guilty and set her free. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, most of the South's Confederate past has been buried, but just recently a curious reminder of the Civil War days was unearthed by a construction worker's backhoe at a site 200 yards from the Savannah River in Georgia. A 200-pound cast iron cylindrical artifact about the size of a gas grill's propane tank was dug up and examined by Army bomb handlers and historians who determined the artifact to be a rare type of Confederate torpedo used to mine Savannah Harbor during the Civil War. The recovery of the weapon is just one of only a dozen discoveries of Confederate mines. Historians expect to find more, but aren't afraid any will explode unexpectedly. Four watercolor paintings and a vast collection of photographs are the subject of a court battle over rights of possession between the United States and the descendants of Heinrich Hoffmann, the personal photographer of Adolf Hitler. The paintings are no ordinary artworks. Each is signed A. Hitler. The vast photo collection includes many rare images of Hitler captured in intimate moments. The plaintiffs have presented their case before the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., arguing that since the Hoffmann material has long since lost its emotionally inflammatory nature, it ought to be returned to Hoffmann's heirs. However, the United States maintains that post-World War II agreements with Germany allowed the U.S. government to seize certain types of German property after the war, and that all deadlines for damage and property claims passed a long time ago. Presently, Hoffmann's photo collection resides in the National Archives, while the four Hitler paintings remain in a climate-controlled basement in downtown Washington. This is Talking History. Most people would agree that studying popular music provides valuable insights into any culture, whether it's jazz, folk music, or rhythm and blues. Some would question, however, the value of examining that part of rock and roll music known as heavy metal. But hear us out as Talking History's Eileen Dugan investigates that subject with Robert Walzer.
Few forms of modern American music have been as publicly vilified as heavy metal. Health experts decry its volume, parents fret over allegedly violent and satanic lyrics, and musicians in other fields declare that it just isn't good music. We tend to hear about heavy metal from its critics. But what do metal musicians and their fans think about their music? What, to them, is the purpose, the value, even the artistry of heavy metal? With us today to discuss this controversial musical form is Dr. Robert Walzer, Chair of Musicology at the University of California at Los Angeles. Professor Walzer is the author of Running with the Devil, Power, Gender, and Madness in Heavy Metal Music. Welcome, Dr. Walzer.
Hi. Good to be here.
How did you, as an academic, get involved in studying heavy metal?
Well, it was really the other way around. I was a music major playing trumpet and heading for a career playing in an orchestra. And I started playing in bands, playing guitar. And and got more and more involved in playing rock music. And then while I was finishing up a doctorate in trumpet performance, I got interested in the idea of studying music, doing musicology. So I switched over and did a degree in musicology. And the book you mentioned was a revision of the dissertation that I wrote.
And how are heavy metal musicians and heavy metal music commonly perceived?
Well, it's changed a lot over time. My book was mostly concerned with the 80s, particularly the late 80s, when heavy metal was the single most popular style of music around. And I got interested in writing the book because of this tremendous popularity, and only critics were being heard from. And so you had millions of people building their lives around this music, and millions of other people who wanted to kill them for it, and it seemed like a really kind of rich area of study. The other thing was that I liked the music. I was impressed by technically how the music worked, and thought it was worth digging into.
What do you think are the most common misperceptions about heavy metal?
Well, I think it's like any kind of culture. If you're outside the culture, it's easy to misread it. It's easy to see something like, oh, Ozzy Osbourne mentions the devil. He must be in favor of Satanism. When in fact, the devil is not a strange topic. 55% of Americans believe in the existence of the devil. You hear about the devil all the time at church services, and that doesn't mean, that people are promoting the devil. So it's just, from the outside, it's easy to misread little bits and not understand the coherence of the culture itself.
What are the origins of heavy metal?
Really comes out of rhythm and blues, and that turns into rock and roll, and that turns into a harder kind of rock in the 60s, and we get a louder, just more distorted sound. The first bands, really, that are usually called heavy metal all formed or all recording around 1969-70. Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, and Black Sabbath.
And why did it become such a phenomenon in the 70s and 80s?
Well, it had cycled. It was popular for a while in the 70s, it then died down, and at the end of the 70s, people thought it was pretty much over. And then there was kind of new wave of heavy metal again in the 80s, and it became the most popular form of the late 80s. And then we had another kind of shift at the turn of the 90s. We had Guns N' Roses and then Nirvana coming along and kind of pulling a lot of the heavy metal audience over toward music that was more punk influenced and, for example, didn't have all the virtuosic guitar solos that were important in the 80s.
To what extent does heavy metal involve a discourse between performers and their audience?
I think what you're referring to, I guess, would be the way that there are a variety of ways that people work at identifying with heavy metal musicians. The musicians are larger, more powerful, more colorful, more successful versions of what fans might like to be. And so fan magazines are very important for a lot of metal fans as a way of getting access to pictures, to interviews, to details about the stars, and helps people connect with them all.
What draws an audience to heavy metal? Is it just the volume or something in the lyrics, perhaps?
Well, heavy metal is a term that it covers a lot of different kinds of music. And I spent some time in the book distinguishing various different kinds of music. You might have people who like a lot of different kinds of heavy metal, or you have people who are very narrow fans of one style. Someone might be a fan of Metallica and hate Van Halen, or in the 80s, you had Poison fans and Judas Priest fans, and they didn't overlap a lot. So each style is not just a set of musical styles, but also certain kinds of lyrical topics show up in some bands and not in others. Poison might sing about love, but Judas Priest won't. And so people are attracted to the bands that deliver the combination, the kind of identity that they want to have. And that involves lyrics, but it also involves costumes, presentation, and also the particular way that the music works.
When you listen to heavy metal, the first thing that hits you is just the power of it. And why is power, and how is power central to heavy metal?
I think power is central to lots and lots of music. It's just that power comes in different forms. When we hear heavy metal, we hear a lot of volume, and we hear a lot of distortion, and those things signal power to us. But if you go to a Mahler symphony, you're going to hear a lot of volume too, and the volume and the sense of power in a piece of music like that is also very, very crucial to the experience that people seek out when they listen to that music. So I talked some about adolescence and heavy metal and how heavy metal serves to give people who don't in fact have a lot of power a feeling of empowerment, people who don't have any economic power, people who may feel marginalized or ignored by society, by their parents, by whomever, can find in heavy metal an experience of being powerful, you know, that is very attractive to them.
And how is power evident in the lyrics of heavy metal?
Well, in a number of ways, I guess. Sometimes you might have fairly aggressive lyrics. Other times you might have lyrics that seem transgressive, like Ozzy Osbourne singing about the dark side of things, about mystery, about the occult. And that's transgressive, and transgressing is a form of power. Or you could have songs about partying. You could have, you know, a whole range of different kinds of topics. But in some way or other, they're all connecting with that desire that, you know, I think not just adolescents, but all of us have, to feel capable, to feel able to act in the world and able to garner some respect.
Among the most interesting topics of your book, I thought, was your discussion of metal musicians' connections to classical music. How would you explain that?
I go through a number of musicians, Eddie Van Halen, Randy Rhoads, who played with Ozzy Osbourne for a while, Richie Blackmore, who was in Deep Purple, and talked about, in all those cases, these are all guitar players who came up having classical music training as kids. Eddie Van Halen practiced Mozart on the piano, and so on. And that early exposure gave them some resources to draw upon later when they started bringing those classical influences into heavy metal in a much bigger way than it happened earlier. And it's an unusual thing. It's the kind of thing you can't predict or make up, that these people would seize on this music and treat it as something that they had every right to claim. And another thing that particularly intrigued me about it is that classical music today tends to be marketed as just a category that embraces everything. It's all straight. It's all interchangeable. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about Monteverdi or Mozart or Stravinsky. It's all marketed the same way by the classical music industry. But these musicians heard very specific things that they were attracted to. They were attracted to Bach and Vivaldi. They were not attracted to, say, Mozart or Beethoven. So they're responding very specifically to ways of making music, to musical resources, to certain harmonic progressions, certain kinds of figuration that they can adapt from the organ or the violin and transfer to the electric guitar. And they weren't daunted by the fact that this wasn't supposed to be their music, or they weren't supposed to be fusing it. They just went right ahead and did it, and I think produced some glorious stuff.
What is the role of women in heavy metal?
Fairly minor, has been. There were a few people, Lita Ford in the 80s, who had some success. It was the case, I think, that heavy metal fans, male or female, tended to respond to male artists, and it was hard for women to do much. That's changed in the 90s somewhat as the genre has blurred more, but still I think overwhelmingly what people would call heavy metal is very male-dominated.
And what about the text? How are women treated in the lyrics of heavy metal?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not at all. Judas Priest, for example, you don't have any mention of gender at all. If there's some reference to a relationship, the sex of the other person isn't mentioned. And this is, you know, partly because Rob Halford was gay when he was with the band. But it's also that it was a way of portraying a world where gender was not an issue, where gender anxieties, which of course are very important for young men, weren't at issue at all. What was at issue was empowerment. So you have that kind of inscription, writing women sort of out of the picture, or occasionally you have overt misogyny. That happens much less than people think it does. A band like Wasp, which really wasn't all that popular, or Motley Crue, which was. You sometimes have romantic heavy metal. Bon Jovi, Poison, bands more toward the pop side of things, who sang out-and-out love songs. And that was a big part of metal's popularity in the 80s. And then you have androgyny showing up, too, the kind of cross-dressing and gender blurring, particularly in the costume and hair and makeup. And so it's a very complicated genre in terms of the different gender identities that it articulates.
And how does madness fit into heavy metal?
Iron Maiden had a song called Can I Play With Madness, and I took that as a chapter title in my book. And I think there's a lot of attractiveness for a lot of people to the idea of breaking through what seems to be too orderly a world, too regimented a world, too restrictive a world, and cutting loose. We can see this in a whole variety of art, not just popular art, not just 20th century. You know, go back to Romantics in the 19th century. Go back to Berlioz. You know, we have the Symphony Fantastique, which is all about drugs and sex and fakeness from its program. So it's not a new impulse. It's one that's easy, again, to misunderstand and to demonize. I think heavy metal fans were, throughout the 80s, often scapegoated, as though society wouldn't have any problems if people weren't listening to Ozzy Osbourne, you know, as though we had a perfectly functioning society except for the kind of music that kids listen to.
Who do you think is the most intriguing heavy metal musician, either past or present?
I guess I can always go back and listen to Eddie Van Halen. I think he has incredible technique, but also has a kind of bluesiness in his playing that just is unmatched, I think. Other than instrumental, I guess Ozzy Osbourne is very interesting. He's had an enormously long career. He still headlines tours now, you know, 30 years later. And he has a kind of interesting blend of positions, I think. He's ironic, but he also seems empathetic. He toys with, satanic references and so on, but he always does it with a sense of humor, a sense of irony. His voice is not anything you would think to write home about, but it's a kind of paranoid whine that seems to speak to a lot of people, seems to represent and articulate something that a lot of people feel, and has done so for decades now.
The musicians that we've been talking about, as you say, Ozzy Osbourne on the road for 30 years, Van Halen on the road for many years, but what do you think is the future of heavy metal music?
Well, that's the question I always hate getting asked, because music works, culture is so complicated, people are so creative, that you can never predict what's going to happen. We can look back on something like that classical influence on heavy metal of the 80s and think, you know, how did that happen? And we can sort of figure out how it happened, but there was no way we could have predicted it, that these kids would get their hands on this old music and make something really new out of it. So right now we're in a period where the genre's kind of blurred, doesn't have a lot of presence on the pop charts. The term is now identified with more underground and heavy, very noisy styles. It could be that, you know, we'll have another resurgence and guitar, you know, virtuosity will come back and metal will be on the charts again, but who knows?
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Walter.
Sure, no problem.
We have been talking with Dr. Robert Walter, Chair of Musicology at the University of California at Los Angeles and author of Running with the Devil, Power, Gender, and Madness in Heavy Metal Music.
The author of this week's commentary, Fred Migliori, hosts a syndicated radio program called FM Odyssey, which looks at the music and the musicians who make FM radio famous. While FM radio was once the place to hear any and all kinds of music, Migliori says it has lost its edge.
Back in the mid to late 60s, FM radio began to find an identity, partly because of new FCC regulations that stated AM stations could no longer simulcast their programming on their company-owned FM stations, and greatly because of the rock idiom that was happening simultaneously. Many people have asked the question, what happened to FM radio and the great rock and roll we grew up with back then? And why doesn't the music being heard on radio today measure up to the music we listened to back then? I think the simplest answer is the word that you see on your milk carton in the back of your refrigerator. The word is homogenized. How I hate that word. Experimentation was the word of the day in the late 60s. Talent and creativeness were the priority both at record companies and on FM radio. So needless to say, you heard everything if you knew where to listen. And FM radio was the place to go. Once FM radio realized there was money to be made, and a lot of it, is when it began its unfortunate demise. As Jonathan Schwartz, a legendary New York DJ, told me of his experience on New York's WNEW-FM back at the beginning, he said radio consultants burst on the scene like a massive oil spill. He went on to say it was like living in France and having someone from Pennsylvania who didn't know the language or the culture come over and teach you French. And that is what the radio consultant did to commercial FM radio to this very day. Now, at the same time, record companies, especially labels who were carrying rock acts, realized very quickly how much money they could make. The overwhelming proof came to them in 1976 with the release of Peter Frampton's Frampton Comes Alive, a record that outsold everything in the market. Thus, the next step was exploitation with the birth of disco, which then caused the FM rock stations to quickly change their formats to compete with their disco stations, which, by the way, were kicking their butts. Quantity equals money became a much higher priority than the quality of what was being made. It didn't matter then, and it still doesn't matter today, how good the music is. It's, will it make us millions, and if not, we're not interested. Thus, we end up with those two words, music business. To me, those words are so opposite in meaning they don't even belong in the same sentence, but there you have it. Take heed, though, faithful listeners, for great rock, folk, and every other kind of music is still being made, and it does stand up to the test of time with our favorites from 30 years ago. But you won't hear it on commercial radio. You have to look hard to find it. But once you do, you will once again find yourself wandering refreshingly through the rolling fields and meadows where the music is still a breath of fresh air.
You've been listening to Fred Migliori, host of the syndicated radio program FM Odyssey. This is Talking History. We've recommended this site before, and we just had to recommend it again. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame honors the legendary performers, producers, songwriters, disc jockeys, and others who have made rock and roll the cultural force it is today. It contains interactive exhibits, films, videos, and priceless artifacts, including cars, clothing, and musical instruments from the biggest names in music. In addition to its permanent exhibits, a number of temporary exhibits are staged throughout the year. Located on the shores of Lake Erie in Cleveland, Ohio, you can catch a number of programs and concerts. Contact the museum or visit their website to see what's coming up later this year at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, the History Channel will premiere two new series at the end of the month that look very interesting. From June 25th through the 28th, the History Channel will air Some Assembly Required, a history of the tools that make up the home improvement trade. On June 25th, Hardware Store will look at the origins of nails, bolts, screws, glue, and duct tape, the staples, if you will, of the hardware industry. On June 26th, Garage Gadgets will give us a historical tour of the things we keep in our garages, lawnmowers, string trimmers, leaf blowers, and barbecue grills. While on June 28th, the series will shift to the tool bench and give some history of the various hand tools, power, and manual that we use around the house. If that reminds you too much of work, try Secrets of the Dead 2, a History Channel series that begins on June 26th and runs through July 31st. On June 26th, watch for Witch's Curse, a history of the Salem Witch Trials. More on other programs in that series as the air dates grow closer. In the meantime, be sure to check your local listings for the exact show times of both History Channel series. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.